Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome. Hi, I'm Carol. I am an alcoholic. I was waiting for a lot more publicity going on or announcements or something. So anyway, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. My name is Carol. I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank my friend Lee for inviting me to come up here and participate in my own sobriety. I'm just overwhelmed sometimes at the quality of life that I have been given. I had my sister visiting me this week from Louisiana. And I love this gal with all my heart and soul. I really do. I just love her. But sometimes I think we were raised on two different planets altogether. I don't think that there's an idea that goes, an exchange that goes on between us that makes any sense to me or me to her either. And yet I'm sitting here with Lee and I'm thinking, I've known him for so many years. And I've watched, I remember when Jessica was the bell ringer, little Jeremiah was just a wee tot. And I've watched Lee all these years, and he's always been front row center in Alcoholics Anonymous. I watched his trials and tribulations. So to be able to come up here, it's beautiful. He couldn't have picked a better day for me to drive up, really. It was a four-hour drive up from Orange, and it was spectacular. You live in God's country up here. It's so beautiful. And to see the same thing I've always seen, his family right there with him, and just Joey. I'm so happy that he found Joey, and I'm just amazed at the quality of life that we are given once we get into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I don't say anything else, you know, if there's nobody new here, I don't know you. Usually there's one hiding somewhere. And if that's you, that I was like you, you know, I want to say welcome. Welcome to a better way of living without chemistry. I always like to get my vital statistics out front so you'll know who I am. I am an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date. It's February 16th, 1982. I have a home group, and that is the Seal Beach Speakers Meeting on Monday night. And I have a sponsor, this little bitty woman, Shirelli, who runs the powwow. She lives out in the desert. Her job is to keep me right-sized, and she does a real good job of that. And those are the two roots I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just hold those things dearly. My sobriety date is the most important event of my life. Took many years to realize this, many years. And once I realized the gift I had been given, I protect that sobriety date with my life. It is the most important event of my life. You know, I never want to forget from whence I came. I think when you're sober, the most important word after you've gone through the steps and after you've done the deal is to remember. I always want to remember from whence I came because I never want to go back to that gracious way of living again. I love speaking at this time of year because at this time of year, in 1981, I was living in Lahaina, Maui at the time, and I got into a lot of trouble. I usually don't talk too much about the kind of trouble I was in, but it's this time of year, and if there's such a thing as cellular memory, I'm feeling it, you know? And I remember the sadness I felt. I just had a horrible miscarriage. I didn't know I was pregnant when I had this miscarriage. And the miscarriage wasn't a pregnancy through love. It was, you can't use the word rape for me. It was kind of forced. But as my sponsor pointed out to me, that when you drink like I drink, and you go where I go, and you do what I do with the people I do them with, you lose the right to say no. So there's no such thing as that, but it was a very, very tense situation. And I was also dancing on the line of legal, illegal, and there was a lot of activity going on. And when I had this miscarriage, I was homicidal. I was crazy. And I tried to kill this man, and my friends took me, and they threw me on a plane, and they sent me back to Mom's house in Boston, in Lowell, Massachusetts. And when I got back to Massachusetts, I was trying to pretend like everything's okay. You know, I was just wrapped up in grief and depression and sadness and fear, and trying to tell my Irish mom that I came home because I wanted to spend the holidays with you, and everything's fine, Mom, everything's cool, everything's great, dying on the inside, just dying on the inside. I was on the wagon, you know, that vehicle that the wheels fall off and you don't pay attention. I was on the wagon, and I was desperately, desperately sad and lonely. My mother was so happy on Thanksgiving, which is a couple of weeks from now, when she had her three alcoholic children all around her, you know, sitting there just beaming. She had her three kids there, and she was so happy. My brother Peter was still, he's an alcoholic. He sneaked down in the basement to drink. I think he's still down in the basement, to tell you the truth. My brother Johnny was pacing back and forth. His sobriety date is December 18th, so he was rounding up the end of his drinking. And all I knew sitting there that day is I had to drink. I could not stand it any longer. I had to have a drink. Every fiber in my body was screaming for a drink. And I'm trying to pretend like I don't drink and everything's cool. So I started that sneaky drinking, you know, that sneaky thing. And it was cold, it's Massachusetts, and I'd stop and I'd get a half pint and go up to my room. I live in those old New England houses with three floors up, and my basement was up on the third floor. And first it was a half pint, then it was a pint, then it was a quart, then it was a half gallon. I'm going to bed earlier and earlier and earlier. It's cold outside, Mom. I need to go to bed. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Got to go now, you know, and just to do that sneaky drinking. And inside, I knew I had to leave. I had to get out of there. I knew I couldn't let my sweet Irish mom see what I turned into when I drank. Now, mind you, I'm defending my right to drink. See, people are whispering about my drinking, but I know it's not the problem. My problem is when I don't drink. Because when I don't drink, these feelings just paralyze me. They just choke me. I can't stand what's going on in my life. I can't stand how I feel. So I overshoot the mark. No big deal. I'm not harming anyone, am I? I'm not bothering you. But I could never figure out why I felt so bad, so awful, when the people that loved me looked at me with that look, you know the look, and they'd ask that question, what is wrong with you? That question I had heard my entire life. But in Maui, it turned out they also added, and why do you drink like you drink? And my answer was, it's none of your damn business. And in my head, I want to tell you what I think. Mind your own business. It's people like you butting into my affairs. Just leave me alone. Can't explain why I feel so bad that I have to leave. See, I don't know how to stay anywhere. I know how to split. I go. And I leave because I don't want to look at that look anymore. So I just split so I can go off and do my comfortable drinking, wondering why you're complaining about it. So I'm doing the sneaky drinking, and I'm just paralyzed with fear. Prior to leaving Maui, I had a little house on Front Street with a swimming pool. I drove a new red Mustang convertible. I wore designer clothes. I had a fabulous job. I had a man that adored me. And while I was back in Massachusetts, I got evicted from the house. The car was repossessed, fired from the job. The man found somebody else to love. And here I am with nothing, nowhere, whatever. But, you know, I'm a real alcoholic. I'll figure it out when I get there. And all I know is I have to get out of Massachusetts and get away. And the only place I know where to go is back to Hawaii. So on January 4th, which was my natal birthday, I said goodbye to my mom and off I went. I was going back to Hawaii. I got there sometime in February. I guess I had a long trip. I drank my way cross country. My brother was out visiting me a couple of months ago, and he refreshed my memory that I was in New York for a while, so at least the trip's getting shorter. I'm putting pieces of it together. But when I arrived in Honolulu, my luggage had fallen apart. Everything I owned was in two shopping bags. And I'm sitting at the airport. I had about $20 in my pocket. I had no job, no home, no friends, no money, nothing. And, you know, but I'm an alcoholic. I'll figure out when I get there. So I'm sitting on this park bench trying to figure out what to do at the airport. And I remember that I had this one friend that I used to drink with, my friend Mary. She had her last drink at my house in Lahaina, and I kicked her out. You know, I kicked her out because I told all my friends she smoked and I was afraid she'd burn my house down. But the truth of the matter is I kicked her out because I came home and all my booze was gone. So I kicked her ass right out the door. I could care less where she landed. And she ended up in this place called St. Francis Women's Alcoholic Treatment Center. And I hadn't heard or talked to her in a long time, so I called her. And she was so happy to hear from me, just delighted to hear from me. And it was her AA birthday. They were celebrating 1 year her birthday. Would I like to come to the celebration? Of course I want to go. Spend the night at the airport or go to the party? Of course I'll go to the party. And when I got there, all these counselors from St. Francis were just coming up and talking to me and carrying on, paying a lot of attention to me, as they should, because this whole event wouldn't have happened if I had kicked her out. I do deserve the credit. That's my ego. I deserve the credit for kicking her out. Otherwise, she wouldn't be here and sober. And they're just buzzing in my ear about nothing at all about drinking. Very democratic they were. They said things to me about finding a better way of living, a different way of living. And the only thing I knew was I was so tired. I had no place to lay my head. I was so tired. And they said that they would have a bed for me on that following Monday. It was President's Day weekend, and Mary was going away for the weekend, so she gave me the keys to her condo. And she said, you can stay here for the weekend, but come Monday, you're gone. I don't care where you go, whatever you do, that's your choice. You can stay here, and then Monday, you're gone. It was Friday, for God's sake. You know, Monday's a long way away. We don't even go there yet. And I'm thinking, if I go into this treatment center, I'm going to have that label, alcoholic, follow me for the rest of my life. Now, I'm a smart woman. I'm educated. And I know I was predestined to be rich and famous someday. And if I go into this treatment center and that label, alcoholic, follows me, I mean, it's going to be all over the press. It's going to be, you know, people all over the world are going to know when I'm rich and famous that I'm an alcoholic. Now, mind you, I have no place to lay my head, and I'm worried about what's going to happen when I'm rich and famous with everything in my two shopping bags, right? kind of a clue. But I don't want to do this. And so the next day was a beautiful Saturday. It was a gorgeous day. And I remember that I had other friends over there, and I called them, and we sailed all day long. It was just a beautiful, beautiful Hawaiian day. And I sailed all day long, and I didn't drink. See, I'm not an alcoholic. I can quit whenever I want. And the next day was Valentine's Day. And, you know, on Valentine's Day in Hawaii, they go to the park and they celebrate. There's the food, there's the music, there's the dancing. And I didn't drink. I'm not an alcoholic. I can quit whenever I want. But the next day was Sunday. And there's something about a Sunday. There's something about a Sunday that just tears me open. I'm a throwaway kid. I grew up and nobody cared where I was or what I did, and I ran the streets. And I remember on Sundays, all my friends had to go home to Sunday dinner and get ready for the week, sit around the parlor, plan their plan, dream their dreams, and I just roamed the streets, and it was just a hole in me on a Sunday that always opened up. I was so sad and so lonely. And when I feel like that, my best thinking told me, why don't I go over to my favorite watering hole, the yacht club, and see what's going on over there. So I went over to the yacht club. I can find an alcoholic man anywhere. There were about 300 men in that room. When I walked in, and I looked around, and I found this merchant marine up in the corner, gave him a big old smile, and he slithered on over to see me. You know, this is 33 years ago. I was still pretty hot. He came right on over, and I told him I was thinking about moving to Honolulu. And he was smitten with me. He thought it was a grand idea. So we ended up going to dinner, and we went to the movies, and then he decided to entice me to move to Honolulu to show me the lights of Tantalus up in the mountain. So up to the mountain we go, and on the way up he stops and he buys a half gallon of Hardy Burgundy, and he takes the top off and he throws it away and he hands it to me. Now he's looking a little bit promising right now. And up to Tantalus we go, and I drank that whole half gallon all by myself. He didn't drink. He was over in the corner smoking his joints, having his own trip, and I drank that whole half gallon of Burgundy. And I'm wondering, how did I get here? How did I get here? I had climbed that mountain of success time and time and time again, and how did I get here? I was so sad, so lost, no money, no job, nowhere in the world to go. How did I get here? It's true what they say, your whole life goes before your eyes, and I was just so bewildered, just bewildered. And so the next day when he dropped me off, I took the bus up Lily House Street. That was February 16th, 1982, and I checked myself into St. Francis Women's Alcoholic Treatment Center, and I haven't had a drink since. You tell me that God has not always held me in the palm of his hands. I got into that treatment center, I looked around, and it was the saddest bunch of people I'd ever in my life seen. I thought, Angela, death with the gun, just shoot me now. Eyes over. And I had a hangover that was so bad. I left my Maui luggage, the shopping bags downstairs, and they showed me my little room. I wanted to go up there and just sleep for about a month. And the next thing I know, the bell goes off. You know that bell, treatment center, ringy, dingy, dingy. And I'm down to the lobby I go, and they're all deciding what meeting they're going to go to. And I'm thinking, meeting? What kind of a meeting? And they said, AA. I'm not going to AA. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not like them. I know what Alcoholics Anonymous is like. I've seen it. Bulbous-nosed old men holding hands, chanting, waiting to die. I am not going there. I don't belong. That's all there is to it. My friend Mary said, well, if you're going to stay here, you have to go to at least a couple of meetings, so why don't you go? Now, prior to this, on Maui, I had worked in retail, high-end retail. So in my shopping bags, I had one designer outfit left. I'm a snob. I love designer clothes. So I wore it. It was a green felt hat with a big peacock feather, matching velour jacket, Calvin Klein jeans when designer jeans were brand new, and knee boots. And off I go to my first meeting. I was hot, man. I was so hot. It was about 99 degrees. I was really hot. And I get there, and they have all these greeters at the door hugging and kissing and rubbing up against. They're so happy to see me. I am not so happy to see them at all. I have a hangover that walks in the room ahead of me. I am so sick. And all these guys, they're just carrying on, and I am just disgusted with the whole lot. All my inmates come to the front where they belong, and I sit in the back by the door where I belong in case I have to make my getaway. And the first woman gets up to speak, and I was so embarrassed for her, Mary Lake. I'll never forget her as long as I live. She's up there chain smoking, telling stories that no decent woman would tell her best friend in private. And she's telling a whole room full of people all of these adventures she'd been on, and you're all clapping, right, Amalia, you're a winner, keep coming back. And I'm back there going, that woman has no breeding whatsoever. The next guy gets up to speak, and his name is Big Richard, and he's big. He's the scariest looking dude I've ever seen. He weighs about 400 or 500 pounds. He drives a garbage truck for a living. He robbed petty cash. He was in an accident. Everybody left him. Even the dog wouldn't sleep with him. I danced back to that treatment center. I did not have what they had, nor did I want it. Not at all. I saw all the differences and no similarities whatsoever. But before I left Honolulu, 2.5 years later, those people became my closest friends. If you had asked me 5 minutes after I left that meeting, I couldn't tell you one single word that was said, not one. But tonight I could close my eyes and I can go around that whole room and tell you everyone that was in that room and their story. They saved my life. I could not believe that over the years, the memory has come back of those beautiful people who spoke the one thing that got to me, and that was the truth. I hadn't heard the truth in a long, long time, and they spoke the truth. But not so that night. I danced back to that treatment center. I could hardly wait to get back there. Regressing for a minute, as I said, I was 2.5 years sober when I left Hawaii, and I'd gotten my nurse's license back, and I was working at this little Japanese hospital, Kuakini Hospital. And Mary's husband, Harry, was dying of cancer. And he got checked into the hospital, and Mary moved into the solarium with her futon to do her step work all around Harry's chemotherapy. And I got to know that woman really well. What a privilege to know somebody like that. And every night after the meetings, all of that Big Richard's hoodlum friends would all show up into Harry's room. They'd be there smoking cigarettes, carrying on. The nurses were terrified of them. They all looked like the mafia. They were so big, and these big Samoan guys. And, you know, and here I am just sitting there thinking to myself, how did I get here? Who are these people? But they saved my life, those two people. But the next night I'm done with AA, so the bell goes off again, and I'm not going. That's all there is to it. I'm not going. And my friend Mary said, well, this is the only time they go in the van, so if you want cigarettes and candy, you better go. So I hop in the van. We stop at the store. I get all my cigarettes and all my candy, and this time we pull into Wailaikahala, which is the Gucci meeting. And on the way in, there's two Rolls Royces and a Mercedes. Now, it's a program of attraction, right? That kind of got my attention. And I looked upstairs, and there are all these handsome men. They have on Aloha shirts, long pants, shoes and socks, smoking away. And, I mean, it was beautiful up there, all these gorgeous men. So I thought, well, maybe I should try one more. So I hop out of the van. I got my peacock feather all adjusted, and up the stairs I go. And this time at the podium is addiction number two. This time at the podium, blonde hair and blue eyes, the handsomest man I had ever seen in my life, and I fell in love. I knew I'd been sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous to marry this man and live happily ever after. That was it. I love at first sight. Always did, always will. If I have to think about it, I want nothing to do with it. And I looked at this man, and I knew this was it. But something strange was happening. I don't know where all this water was pouring out of my hands, just pouring out of my hands. I'm spitting at you when I talk, I'm beet red, I'm scratching everywhere, I'm detoxing, basically, is what's happening. And the only thing that will come out of my mouth is, ah, you know, that's not very sexy. But I, you know, when they say, you know, mirror people, I knew that. I had that down to a science. I listened to what he said, and wherever he went, I went. Steps to Freedom was his home group. Steps to Freedom became my home group. He was at meetings 7 nights a week. I was right there with him. 2 on Saturday, 2 on Sunday. Wherever he went, I went. Whatever he did, I did. But you see, I'm old-fashioned. I expect the man to make the move. So I'm sitting there with my back turned to him, waiting for him to come up and profess his dying love for me, and he's not doing it. And I'm out every single night of the week trying to get this man's attention, and he's not paying any attention to me. And after so many months, I said, forget about it. It's not worth it. And that's the night he walks by, pats me on the head, and said, keep coming back, you're a winner. Now that's a come on, right? I know he feels the same way. I know he does. So I'm 6 months following him around. I wanted to look like I was doing the deal, so I got a sponsor, Yoshiko, who graduated the month before I did from the treatment center. Didn't speak one single word of English. It was perfect for me. I could tell her whatever I wanted and not worry about her repeating it. She just would tell me how wonderful I was. And she was my sponsor. I was very happy with her, really. And at 6 months, I finally get a date with this guy. Now, any woman who tells you different this is not telling the truth. But before he showed up that night, I'm naming our children. We're going to have three. Where we're going to live. He needed a whole makeover, of course, and I'm planning our whole life. And the phone rings, and when the phone rings, it's my brother telling me my mom had died suddenly that day of a heart attack. My mom's not supposed to die and leave me. I mean, I was devastated. I was devastated. And when he came to pick me up, I thought he would comfort me, but he didn't comfort me. He put me in his car, and he took me to a little meeting out at the North Shore, a little meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told those people what had happened. I had not one penny to my name. I was stone cold broke. And they took up a collection so I could go back to Massachusetts to my mom's funeral. And you think I would have gotten the message then, but I didn't. You see, when I drink, I'm not a nice person. I am self-centered to the max. They took up a collection. I've been using people all my life. What's another group? What's another group to use? That's who I am when I drink. I am not nice at all. And the next day when he took me to the airport, I told him, you know, my mom was quite prominent. It's going to be a big Irish wake, so I'm going to have at least one drink. And he slammed on the brakes and he said, you don't drink if your ass falls off. What's wrong with you? And he made me angry. I love anger. I still do. It gets me moving. It gets things done. And I thought, I'll show you. You know that, I'll show you. So I went back to Massachusetts and I conducted myself as much of a lady as I knew how to. And I came back thinking he'd meet me with a ring and we'd get married and live happily ever after. But he met me instead with a big book and a schedule of meetings. And he told me I had a disease that was killing me and he didn't care to watch it. Get a sponsor, get a program, get a life. And he abandoned me at the airport. I was devastated. Here I am, an orphan, for God's sakes, and he's abandoning me at the airport. And at the time I was working as a maid up on Round Top Drive, and I went home and I cried for days. I went from the couch to the bed and sobbed and cried. I was so, so sad. But as I said, when the sadness left, then my favorite emotion kicked in, and that's anger, and I'll show you. I'll show you good. And so Steps to Freedom was his home group. He loved that meeting, so I showed him, all right. Got rid of all the sober clothes, got the hunt clothes back out, you know, those that are cut down here and slid up to there. And I went to that meeting every Tuesday night, and I glared. I was just so busy glaring at him so he could see what he was missing out on. And while I was busy glaring, they had those elections. You know those elections that they have here where you're railroaded into things? I'm just glaring away, and the next thing I hear it announced that I'm the literature person. I don't want to be the literature person. I don't want anything to do with you people. But they handed me this rack that was the tackiest thing I'd ever in my life seen. It was gooey and sticky with coffee and jelly donuts, and it was disgusting. I was embarrassed for you. And so I didn't know I was a perfectionist when I'm falling off bar stools, but that thing was disgusting. So I took it home. I threw all your literature out because it was just disgusting. I didn't want to go through it, so I threw it all away. Got that rack, and I sanded it, and I varnished it, and I painted it. And I went down to central office, and I bought every bit of literature they had. Now, I worked in high-end retail, right? So I had alphabetized and color-coded. Now I had my vehicle for revenge every single meeting. I was the literature person. I just waited. I had a display like you can't believe. And they'd say, now Carol is ready for the literature announcement. And I would be up there like the banner white of AA, going through every pamphlet, everything. And all they'd do is pat me on the head and say, keep coming back. You're doing a great job. You know, little did I know, I was doing that out of a total resentment. A total resentment. And all I was doing was laying a brick in the road of my recovery without any knowledge of it whatsoever. The commitment's work. And while I'm busy just doing this whole deal, and all of a sudden one day I just think, you know, this is getting ridiculous, and I'm getting upset, and I take another look at him, and he's not looking so promising at all, you know, and I'm just really baffled about what's going on. And, you know, when I was so sad on the couch in the back and forth that time, I also heard over and over and over again about the steps. In Honolulu, every time a newcomer showed up, we went on to step one, step one, step one, step one. It took us about 4 years to get up to the fifth step, I swear. And so I decided, I didn't know my story. I didn't know where I had been. I was living in a state of denial very, very happily. And I heard about the steps, and I decided one day, I can't stand living like this. I don't like this guy, he doesn't like me, I don't know what's going on, and so I decided I would try the silly steps. I'll do them. And so I set aside a Sunday to do them. You know, there are 12 of them. You know, I knew there was a lot, so I wanted to make sure I was rested before I started. And I looked at them, and of course I only picked out the ones that applied to me. Not on the Paulus or Alpha, I don't think so. You know, God will get back to him. And so of course I went right to the fourth step. Now Yoshiko is still my sponsor, who doesn't speak English, and she invites me down for sushi every Sunday. So at the time, I am living on black coffee and smoking cigarettes, and I vibrate. I just can't sit still. You know, I'm one of those just going. And I'm chain smoking, and down the hill I go in my dusty, rusty Pinto to her house with sushi. And on the back of a book of matches, I do my fearless and moral inventory. I do it. I write it all. And I get down to Yoshiko's house, and I read it to her. And she looks at me, and she tells me what a sweet, wonderful girl I am. Well, the steps are working. And so after sushi, I decide I'd go right to the amends. So I, on another book of matches, I make a list of the people I owe amends to. I got home, it was about 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. Thank God no one, most of them weren't home. And this is what they got. This is Carol Mulvey. I'm calling you from Hawaii. I owe you an amends. I'm an AA. Here's your amends. Goodbye. Click. You know? And I went right through them all. And by midnight, you had a spiritual giant on your hands. I had gone from this form of insanity to that form of insanity. St. Francis, move over. Your replacement is here. And the reason I tell you that story is that it's true. There's no wrong way to do the steps, none whatsoever. So I'm over here, and I'm that newcomer at every single meeting, blah, 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 right? And I'm all Big Richard and Mary would do is pat me on the head and say, you're doing great. Keep coming back. You're a winner. God, you got to love the old-timers. You just got to love them. And I had no money, and I had no friends. And I'm in Honolulu, and now I'm working as a maid, as a housekeeper, crying the whole time, going, I was born to have one, not be one. And I had no place to go. And I am the newcomer. I'm that person who was the last one in and the first one out. I really didn't want anything to do with any of you. I really didn't. I was just crazy. And I got a year, and I don't even want to tell you what I said at my first year birthday. It's pretty vulgar. Where's my chip and yeah, whatever. And in the meantime, all these meetings I'm going to, this beautiful woman keeps looking at me. And then she came up to me one day, and she looked at me, and she asked me that question I'd been asked all my life. You know the question? What is wrong with you? You keep showing up here, and you're getting goofier by the day. You are absolutely stock-raving nuts. What is your problem? And she's blah, 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 and I'm ready to tell her what my problem is. It's you, you old biddy. Mind your own business. Why don't you just buzz off, blah, 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 and I'm just waiting for her to take a breath. I'm just going to let her have it. I'm so fed up with these old women telling me what to do, blah, 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 blah. And when she stops, I'm ready to let her have it, and I hear these words fall out of my mouth when she said, meet me tomorrow night. Yes, ma'am. I don't know where they came from. I don't know where they came from, but I said, yes, ma'am. And I met Blanche the next day, and she is the one. I met her at Coco's, and she took me through the steps. I didn't want to go through the steps, but she took me through the steps. I met her at Coco's, and she said, you know, you've been coming around here for a while, and I've been watching you, and you're crazy. You haven't even done this work here. Maybe you're an alcoholic, maybe you aren't, but don't you think you want to stick around long enough to find out? Why don't we just do this our way? You've done it your way, you're crazy, let's do it my way and see what happens. So I decided, okay, I'll try it. You know, I was afraid of her. I don't know why I was afraid. I wasn't afraid of anybody, but I was afraid of her. I asked her to be my sponsor, but I was afraid of her. And so whatever she told me to do, even though I hated doing it, I did it because I was afraid of her. And so she started reading the big book to me, and then she told me I'd been here long enough, it was time for me to do my fourth step. I don't want to do a fourth step. She said, you do your fourth step. And I had gotten my nurse's license back, and by this time, You know, I've been around for a while. Things are going okay. Not good, but okay. And I had issues. I had real issues. I needed a husband. I needed a job. I needed some money. I had other things I had to do besides this fourth step and this fifth step. And I would call her with my issues, and she would slam that phone down and say, "You're writing, click." That's all she would say, "You're writing, click." And I just kept writing. And I want you to know, I'm that person that did my fourth step under the covers at night with a flashlight. I started doing it. I'd say, "Where do I start?" She said, "Start where you were born." And so I started writing. And I wrote it all down. And when I looked at it, I didn't want to share it with anyone. Not with anyone. And she had set aside a day for me to do my fifth step. And I knew the day she showed up at my house, once she heard my fifth step, there would be none of this, "Keep coming back, you're a winner." There'd be, "Get the hell out of here. We do not want your kind here. Get out, get out, get out." And I didn't want to get thrown out. I did not want to get thrown out. And she showed up at my house that day with this big, beautiful bouquet of Hawaiian flowers. I still can't look at Red Torch Ginger without thinking of Blanche. And she had this big bouquet of flowers and a little white candle. And she lit the little white candle and said, "Let's get on our knees and say the third step prayer. Let's ask God to come in here and invite him in so he can help you be honest." And I don't know what happened. Spiritual awakening, I don't know what happened. But I sat there with her for hours, and I told her all my secrets and all my fears and all my guilts and all my shames. And I never want to forget that beautiful face looking back at me ever again in my life. Beautiful. And at the end of it, she said, "You know, there might be some things left unsaid, so you sit here with your God. Meet me at the meeting tonight, and we'll talk again. We'll go for coffee and talk again." And I met her that night, and we talked some more, and that is the day I walked freedom from bondage. I have been free ever since. Ever since, the steps work. They really, really work. What I found out in that inventory is who I was. I didn't know who I was. I'm a Boston Irish Catholic, which enables me membership from birth. I come from crazy. I love crazy. I always have. I always will. Clancy talks about not liking the term dysfunctional. I like dysfunctional family because it's a lot nicer than what they were calling us. I have, for every 12-step program there ever was or there ever will be, I had that applicant in my living room. My mom was a rageaholic. She was always, always angry, always furious. My brothers were just wild. We had drunk uncles. We had an uncle shooting heroin up on the porch up before it was so popular. We had uncles that came back from the war, and they were called a shell shock then, but they call it PTSD today. And in the middle of the night, they'd start looking for the enemy, shooting guns off, and we kids would get up and help them look for them. You know, that's just the way it was. And, you know, I don't know, we couldn't get out of the refrigerator. It was crazy. It was just crazy. But I don't stand here because of that. I stand here because I am an alcoholic, and it's what I did with the environment I came from. And I developed my first addiction when I was really young. That first addiction was reading. I didn't read to learn. I didn't have any goals to be anything. I just read to escape. I wanted to get out of this environment. I just wanted to hide, to disappear. And I set my plans in motion. My plans were I was going to grow up, and the first thing I was going to do is get the hell out of Lowell, Massachusetts. Get out of there. And the other goals I set was I was going to wear beautiful clothes and travel the world around and have all these handsome men chasing me. And thanks to alcohol, I achieved all those goals. I graduated from high school, and I went off to Boston to be a nurse. I had absolutely no desire to be a nurse whatsoever. I had a desire to get out of Lowell, Mass. And when I got to Boston is when my life changed. My story can be summed up in two lines. Alcohol gave me wings to fly and then took away my sky. I like to describe what I look like. I'm a visual person, like I said. I was as skinny as a pencil. I had bright red hair that stuck out to here. I had freckles everywhere, and I spit at you when I talked. Vision for you, right? That's what I looked like. And I'm there, and all my classmates, one night we're going to go down the Peppermint Lounge, down the Combat Zone. Would I like to go? I'll go anywhere I'm invited. I feel like a real geek, but I go. And I get down there, and all of my heroines drank scotch and soda. And there was a song out at the time, Scotch and Soda. So I shimmied up to the bar, and I had a scotch and soda, and it's holy water. It's magical. It's mystical. It's a shame we let normal people drink it. They don't appreciate it the way we do. They just don't. And everything it's supposed to do, it did for me. My hair got straight. It was so good, I had another one instantly. My hair got straight. Those freckles disappeared. I grew bumps where I needed them. I could dance in time to the music at the Peppermint Lounge. All these men were telling me how smart I was, how sexy I was. Hell, I'd been reading for years. I had a lot of material to pass on. I loved drinking. I, blackout drinker, who cares? Small price to pay for the relief I'm getting. You know, I guess I was a fighter, I was told, which I found very unlikely. I'm a sweet little Boston girl here that wouldn't say a bad thing to anyone. And the next day I'd come to and I'd have all these bruises. I thought I was just clumsy. That's all there was to it. I didn't know I was picking fights with these people, but I did. I believed them. And I'm out there drinking all night long, and I'm one of those nurses that slid by. In those days, the uniforms were so starchy, they could have walked to work by themselves with all the studs. And I'd get that uniform on, and I'd slide by the oxygen tent and take a couple of whiffs. That stuff works. I was doing it in the 60s, and I get no credit for what they're doing today. None whatsoever. I've always been ahead of my time. And I'd take a couple of whiffs of that oxygen and off to work I'd go. And tonight I'm going to go straight home. I could never predict what will happen when I pick up a drink. And I'm not going to drink today, and I drink. And I'm not going to drink, and I drink. And bad things were happening, and I don't care because I can finally breathe. I finally fit in that one place I never fit, in my own skin. I graduated, and it was time for me to get on with this life I had planned. So with eeny, meeny, miny, mo, so off to Miami I went in February. It was bitter cold. I knew I had to get out of the cold. I went down to Florida with $100 in my pocket, I guess. And, you know, people say that alcoholics don't have any willpower. They don't know us. Because by God, when we have something that has to be done, it's going to get done once we set our mind to it. And I was busy trying to find a place to live. I got a little job in a dock-in-a-box type place, and there's not much socializing going on there. All the patients were Cuban, and the staff were colored and Cuban, and you know, I didn't speak Spanish. So anyway, I just would walk back and forth to work. And one day, I went to this one store, and these gals were putting up an ad for a roommate. And they were all airline stewardesses that went flying all over the world, and they needed someone basically to stay in the house they were renting. And they brought me over, and this was, I arrived. This was a big mansion on the Miami River, 3-car garage, Olympic-sized swimming pool, exquisitely furnished, and I moved in. I was so excited. My life is now taking off the way I want it to be. And I made sure that place was perfect. I had a yard man, a pool man for all occasions. I'm all but blowing dust out of the keyhole, scrubbing the pool with a toothbrush, making sure it was perfect, because I'm not going to be asked to leave here. And they came home and they looked and they said, all you do is work. Don't you want to have some fun? I was so ready to have some fun. Man, was I ready to have fun. And the following week, there was a party down at the Quarterdeck Club, which is a private key club. These were private clubs in those days. And as I said, I was so excited about it. I went down to Verdine's and I bought a new hunting outfit, cut down here, slid up to there. I was dressed on Wednesday. I had no idea where I was going, but I was ready. And they picked me up, and they put me in their car, and they took me to a part of town I had no business being in. It was a dark part of town, down the alley, up the stairs, knocked 3 times, what's the password? And finally, it opens. And it's this private club, and I get in there, and it's so smoky you could cut it with a knife. And it's the clinking of the glasses and the jazz band playing, and I am in heaven. And when that smoke clears, I told you about love at first sight, right? I look into these big brown eyes and my heart just flip-flops. I never saw a more handsome man in my life. I looked at him and I said to my friend, I'm going to marry him. She said, you're engaged. I said, details, that's the man I'm going to marry right there. You know, kind of get my sense of commitment. And I looked at this man and women can understand this. I chased him until he caught me. He was an international yachtsman. I knew I was totally out of my league and, you know, he was the love of my life. He was then, he is to this day. We got together and we ended up with a romance and it was fabulous. We shared with each other all our secrets and all our dreams and all our fears and all our aspirations. We knew everything about each other. We sailed the Atlantic, we sailed the Pacific, we skied in Aspen, we fished in Baja. And we were the happiest just holding hands and you are my sunshine, whatever. I believe in soulmates. He was my soulmate. And I love that man with all my heart and soul, and I know he did me too. But you know, there's only one reason we're not together, and that reason is alcohol. If you ever get sober, he can come here and tell you his version, but I'm here tonight, you hear my version. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm bodily and mentally different than my fellow man, and I am. When I put alcohol in me, I can never predict what will happen. I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is that I think I'm okay. It affects my vision. You see, I can't see anything wrong with me whatsoever, but I can sure see what he's not doing for me. I can sure see where I'm not living, what I'm not driving, what I'm not wearing, what he's not doing. I can see it. And I have a tongue that trips acid like a razor blade. And I'm not proud of it. I'm my mother's daughter. And I stand here tonight to tell you there are things you can say to people that they will forgive you for, but they'll never forget. They are that cutting. But worst of all, it affects my feet. I take off with people I shouldn't be with and go places I shouldn't be going, and that's not conducive to a good marriage. And I told you earlier, I'm a fighter, so I throw the first punch, and he throws a punch, then I throw another punch. And it's the whole brouhaha. We have the police, we have the firemen, we have the doctors, we have the ambulance, and my finger's always out. You know, it's your fault, it's your fault, I'll show you. And one night I went out and I found his replacement, a pilot up in Oregon, so I divorced this man and off I went. See, I don't know how to stay, I know how to leave, I know how to go, I just keep going. And I got up to Oregon, and surprisingly enough, I picked the same man with a different face. Everything was good for a while. But before long, it's the fight, it's the brouhaha, it's the whole thing all over again. And we had a horrible fight one night, and he stormed out, and the next thing I knew, the police were knocking on my door to tell me he had been killed in a head-on collision by a drunk driver. And my first reaction is, what's going to happen to me? What about me? What about me? It's always, what about me? And I had friends down in Laguna Beach, and I moved down to Laguna Beach, and I was broken. I was sad. I'm in my 20s here. I am a widow. I'm a divorcee. I'm just broken. I'm like a black widow spider. Don't come near me because you'll die. That's all there is to it. You'll die. And I still insist on being a nurse, so I'm out drinking with my friends. All my friends in Laguna were all college graduates, but they were working all the beach houses, making all this money as cocktail waitresses. I'd be out drinking with them at night, get up at dark, 100, iron that white uniform, off to work I'd go. Patients are throwing up, I'm throwing up, and they wanted me to take care of them. It was getting sloppy. So I, too, became a cocktail waitress, thank you, God, because I don't have those horror stories to tell you today about my nursing career. At the time, I'm living in Laguna, and some friends of mine were opening a cannery in Newport Beach, so I went up to the cannery, and I moved up to Lido, and I had a little house, and I was just so happy. I was making more money than I ever made in my life. I learned to surf. I'm surfing all day, sailing all day, living the beach life, making all this money, having a great time. And everything was good until I got cold. I don't do cold real well. And I got a little bit lonely, but I don't want to have another relationship because, you know, I feel like a black widow spider, and I don't really want to get any more involvement with anyone. You know, women can think the same way men do at times. They just want you here when I want you here and not when I don't. And I found the perfect solution, and that was the married bartender over at the Red Onion. Because we all know that married men don't leave their wives, right? Like Fatty left her. Didn't even like them, just like having an affair with them. And, you know, it was sloppy. And, you know, it was fine for a while until, you know, Clancy talks about that moment when you can't be bad anymore. You can only be bad for so long that it's time to be good. And I was feeling a little bit tacky about this because he was married to a friend of mine, and I was feeling a little bit tacky about it. And so I broke up with him, but I'd already found his replacement, and I went off to Mexico for a month, and I said goodbye to him. But while I was gone, he had had that moment of clarity and decided he wanted to spend his life with me. And I came back, and he and his wife had split up. They had split up all their property. She had moved to Colorado, and he's mine, all mine. I told you I didn't even like him, but he's mine, all mine, so I didn't want to look bad, so I lived with him for another 7 years, just to be sure, you know. And I realized later on, all of the stuff that I know now has been through step work. And I didn't realize this, but I could be bought for a price, I guess. You know, I worked. My money was for me, and your money was for me. And I would get a moment of clarity every now and then and look at them and go, what am I doing here? I don't even like you. And they'd say, well, don't you want a new car? Or don't you want to go to Mexico and Central America for 6 months? And it went on and on like this. And finally, he decided to move back to Hawaii. He had property in Maui. And when he left, I thought, you know, my life is a mess. I had that feeling. It was time for me. Playtime is over. It's time to be a grown-up. It's time to be responsible. And so when we broke up and he moved to Maui, I decided that I was going to get a job and get on with my career and get on with my life. But I had long since crossed over that alcoholic line, long since. I'd always had caretakers picking up the pieces. And I'm now an unattended woman drinking in the bars of Newport Beach, unattended. And those things that happened to women drinking alone in the bars began to happen to me, and I got scared. I got really scared. I could not stop drinking. I had a secret. My secret had a secret. The secret was, I can't stop drinking. I think I want to, and I try to, but I can't stop drinking. And I don't want to admit that. I don't want to admit that. I tried the control stuff, and I would just go for so long, and I'd be okay. And then I'd pick up a drink. And at first, it'd be okay. It'd be okay. It'd be okay. Boom. Something would happen. I could never put the pieces together. And one thing that happened to me, I was in a horrible car accident. And he got wind of it. I was in the hospital for quite a few months, and I took a long time to recuperate, and he called every week and decided that I should go to Maui and we should try it one more time. And I went over to Maui, vowing to him that this time things would be different. They were different, all right. How could I possibly keep my word to him when I can't keep it to myself? He was the opening bartender at Chemo's, and I got a job as an office manager for a tax man. Hadn't filed in 5 years, but I got the job because I showed up for work. You know, I'm from Boston. No matter how tough it gets, I show up for work. I might get there and throw up all day and sleep at my desk, but I'm there at work. And I'd get out of work at 5 o'clock, and I'd go over just to watch the sunset, to have one drink, just to hear one song. And I can't predict what will happen when I pick up a drink. And most nights, you get home before I did. You know, tourism is the number one industry over there, and I was doing my part. There were a lot of people over there with a lot of money, and I was showing them a good time. You know, that's just what I did. And eventually, he got word of it, and he kicked me out. He kicked me out, and when he kicked me out, I was furious. How dare he treat me like this? How dare he treat me like this? And this man had his eye on me, and he was the commodore of the yacht club and the president of the Chamber of Commerce, and he owned all the retail stores in Maui. And he hired me to become his right-hand lady. And like I said, here I am with this fancy little house and the Mustang and the pool, and everything looks good. Everything looks good. And I'm drinking out of control every single night. Drinking out of control, blackout drinker, always making excuses, dying one step at a time. One step at a time. I tell this story very infrequently lately, but I seem to have a lot of time. I can remember everything looks good on the outside, and I'd go for one drink just to watch the sunset, and I can never predict what will happen or where I will end up. And I ended up drinking in the seediest and the lowest bars in Lahaina. And one night I went out to Kapalua. I was dressed to the nines, and it was a big event. My boss was getting a big award, and I was right there with him. And I was beautifully dressed, and everything was cool, and I had my Pui Fuse, and I was sipping it. And it ended too early, and I thought, you know, it's a shame to waste all this. Really, it's a shame. I should drop by the yacht club and let those guys see what they're missing out on. That's my thinking. And so I stopped just for one drink, just to watch the sunset, and it gets away from me. And I come to the next morning, and I've been gang raped and beaten with an inch of my life. And I don't know how I got out of that room, but I did. And I crawled down the back stairs. I had no shoes, no purse. My pari was ripped to shreds. I was bleeding, and I staggered on home. And all the Japanese ladies are out there watering their lawns like they do early in the morning. And when they look at me, they don't come to my aid because they had seen me like this before, and they would have seen me that way again. That's not the worst thing that happened to me when I was drinking, but that's the thing that sticks out to me the most. I got home and I had to break into my apartment because I had no keys. And I got into the apartment, I broke in, and I sat on the couch and I poured myself a drink. And I sat there choking on my own self-disgust because I knew I was responsible for the way I was living, and there was nothing I could do about that. That memory was so far suppressed. I was about 7 years sober when I heard Father Leo speak, and he said, "Find your moment. Find that moment." And the truth always has a way of clawing itself to the surface when it's ready. And that night came back to me. And I remember calling my sponsor just hysterically, just sick. I could smell it. I could feel it. I could taste that whole night. And that's when she said to me, "You know, you lost your rights, but I promise you this. I promise you this, that if you stick with us and you do what we do and go where we go, things like that will never happen to you again." And you know what? She was right. They don't. So here I am in this treatment center now, years later, and I'm just stumbling along, and I am not knowing what's going on. And I work my way through the steps, and I honestly don't know why I stayed for so long. I didn't know it for many, many years, but today I know. I stayed because this is the only place where people were kind to me. Everyone was so kind to me. They were so nice. They'd ask me, how are you? And they'd listen for the answer. They'd take me for a ride. They'd take me to the parties, to the potlucks. They'd pick me up for meetings. They'd take me to the dances. They'd take me to the potlucks. And I was irate and I was crazy and they just smiled and they were so nice. And as I said earlier, it's the only place I heard the truth. When I was newly sober, they always made me have commitments, but after the literature commitment, when Blanche was my sponsor, she made sure I had commitments that didn't involve talking to people because I was so vulgar and so rude. Profanity was my native tongue, and I wanted nothing to do with you. I was just figuring out a way to get out of here. I just buy another man. I needed a husband. I needed something, but not you. But while I was doing these commitments, I'd hear your stories. You know, they say what the heart says, the heart hears. And I'd be there and I'd hear your stories, and all of a sudden I began to defrost a little bit. And, you know, that happened to me, and yes, I felt that way. And did that happen to you? And slowly, I defrosted. And after 7 years of being around here, just biding my time, I'd moved back to the mainland, and God kept me dirt poor for a long time, because if I had any money, I would have split. And I was told I had to be self-supporting through my own contributions. That's a whole new deal that was not in my program. That was never on my to-do list. And I came over here to the mainland, and I got Mary Regan for a sponsor. God, she was black, Belgian, mean. She was so, everyone thought she was a nice lady. She wasn't nice, she was mean. I never had a good idea in my life, and no matter what it wasn't good enough. Go to a meeting, put money in the basket. What do you mean put money in the basket? I'm broke. Well, AA doesn't need your money, Carol, but if you put money in the basket, maybe you'll find yourself buying a little bit of dignity and a little bit of respect and a little bit of belonging. You know, what can you do with an answer like that, you know? Well, she nursed me along when I first moved over here. She was a big circuit speaker, and she took me everywhere with her. And all she'd do was every place would go, this is my new baby, like she was so proud of me. And I thought I was really, really special. And I met all these wonderful people, Keith and Lynn Wilder and all these people. I felt so special. I was special. Then she got another baby and I was replaced. You know, I was moved to the side. And I had to stay because I just did what she told me to do, no matter what. Resentful the whole time. I mean, arrogant, belligerent, not a nice person at all. And slowly, I began to do what you do and feel what you feel. And okay. So at 10 years of sobriety, I'm working the best program I can at the time. It's kind of a mediocre one. But you know, by then I'm kind of well known because of Mary, and I'm wearing a suit, and I got a pretty good job, and I'm making a little bit of money, and I'm being asked to speak, and I'm beginning to feel like I'm something. And this man starts paying attention to me. Not my kind at all. You know, I'd done things my way, so Mary said to me, why don't you try doing it differently? So I listened to him, I let him call me and go out for a date and go to dinner, and you know, he began to grow on me. He was in the program. And I eventually realized I love being an AA couple. It's nice to be an AA couple. You have somebody to go out with every Saturday night, picks you up, he's a driver. You know, it was what I love being an AA couple. And 2 years into this relationship, he abandoned me for somebody else. He found an older, richer, blonde midget from Newport Beach, and I was replaced. I was insane. I was shattered. I didn't love him. I knew that, but I loved being an AA couple, and he abandoned me, and I was shattered, and everybody knew about this but me. Everybody knew about him sneaking around but me. And so I was disgusted with all these members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt so betrayed, just betrayed. And my friend Lynn Wilder is the one who gathered me together and just wrapped me up and said, it doesn't make any difference. And I had to change everything I was doing. They turned me over to Clancy. They turned me over to Clancy because he's the only one who could handle me. And Clancy is the one who taught me to go forward. If I have one hand in the sponsors and one in the sponsees, I don't have another hand left to drink. And to do what I do, it doesn't make any difference what you think, what you feel, or what you know, it's what you do. And I'm living proof if you have one hand in the sponsors and one in the sponsees and you keep doing the deal, you walk through your problems, they disappear through neglect. Mary taught me to laugh. Clancy taught me structure and discipline. And I walked through that. And all of a sudden, one day, I walked into the Spirit again one more time. Every birthday means something to me. In 20 years of sobriety, I woke up and I thought, they're having a big party for me. And I thought, this is a lie. This is a big lie. I know I've done something. And by then, I'd gotten Shirelli for a sponsor because it was time for me to get a woman sponsor. And I called her and I said, cancel the party. It's a lie. And she said, well, maybe that's God's present to you. Maybe it's time for you to get back to basics. So 20 years of sobriety, I dived into AA again. I got in the middle. I had the coffee commitment. I'm the GSR. I was the secretary. I was the greeter. I love being a greeter. A greeter's the best commitment ever. You stand at that door. We have a big meeting. There's about 350 people at our meeting. And I stand at the door greeting, and these people come in. They want to know how I know they're new. I know they're new. It's a flat look on their face. And I throw them in the greeting line, and we don't ask them what they want. We just tell them what to do, and the next thing you know, they're getting 30 days and 60 days and 90 days in a year. And it's just so incredible. It's just so incredible to see this thing happening before our eyes. And at 30 years of sobriety, I had an itch I couldn't scratch. I just couldn't scratch it. I have a wonderful life. I sponsor so many beautiful women. We have a meeting in my house once a month. My neighbor gets all dressed up because they all look like models coming into the door. He just is over there ready to take pictures or whatever, you know. And, you know, the greatest honor in my life is that I never got through the romance part, but the greatest thing in my life is when you see these broken people coming up to you with their sad tears and their broken lives and broken dreams, and they say, hey, will you help me? And you bring them into your world. The greatest honor is to be asked to participate in somebody's life. And all of a sudden, you see the changes happening to them. And I'm not smart enough to do anything new or different. All I know is my story, what worked for me. Get a commitment, get a home group, call me every day, work with others, do the deal. Just do the deal. I don't want to hear your complaints. Just do the deal. Do the deal. And they do it. And the next thing you know, I see them dating, and then I see them getting engaged, and I go to the weddings, and next thing you know, we go to the birthday parties, the graduations, the weddings, all of it. And the next thing you know, the babies are coming, and not one of my girls is allowed to have a baby unless I'm in the delivery room. Hold it until I get there. And so far, they've all obeyed, all of them. And there's absolutely nothing more miraculous in the world than to watch a living child come into this world. It's God's perfection, absolute perfection. And I sit back and I see three things happen in that room. Three people are being born. You see that beautiful child, God's creation, come into the world. And you see a silly, goofy little girl turn into a mother. And a playboy boy turn into a father. And you see the family unit begin. And now we have the birthday parties. And you see the difference between the alcoholic home and a home with sobriety. You see the love. You see the service. You see the honesty. You see the joy in the children's lives. It's just absolutely miraculous to be part of that. My life is better than I've ever imagined it could possibly be. As I said, at 30 years, I had this itch I couldn't scratch. I just knew there was more. I am so content and so overblessed and so overpaid in sobriety, but I had an itch that there was more. And Len Wilder, who's been co-sponsoring me for over 30 years, I was at the South. He'd been trying to get me to Al-Anon all these years, and I went, what are you, out of your mind? I just started caring about people. Now you want me to change that? Forget about it, right? But I decided that year that I would say yes to everything if it wasn't illegal or immoral. And I was at the South Bay Roundup a year ago, and Len, I don't know what he did, but this is my interpretation of it. He picked me up out of my chair, and he threw me at Larstein and said, fix her. And I'm sitting there looking at her going, oh, great, you know. But I kept my word. I said I would say yes. And she told me what to do. She said I'd be honored to sponsor you, which was a surprise. And she told me to call her every week. And things began to happen. The first thing that happened is I loved being a newcomer. I loved being a newcomer. To go someplace and wah, 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 and bitch and moan, I loved that. And not to be have any answers. And I hated it. Every meeting I went to was, dear God Almighty, that's an hour of my life I'm never going to get back again. And, you know, but I just felt like I knew Lynn cared enough about me that maybe he could see something I couldn't see. So every meeting I went to was the last meeting I was ever going to go to, just like when I was sober, I made the connection, and I kept going. And slowly by slowly, the gossamer curtain pulled back, and I got to see exactly the hardest bit for me to swallow. The hardest thing for me to swallow was how much harm and pain I had caused the people who loved me when I was drinking. I never realized the impact I had on them and the pain that I caused them. The amends have been made, but it's given me a whole new vertical on how to look at life and relationships, and I'm a much better sponsor as a result of it. I'm a much better sponsor as a result of it, because now I can see different sides to different things. And the thing I learned is I thought there was more. There is so much more. There is so much more. There's more to learn. There's more to see. There's more to do. There's more to give. There's more to love. So much more. It enhanced my life tremendously. It will never be my primary meeting, but it certainly has colored beautifully, given me a whole new outlook on the life that I live today. I think so often about how that woman who landed at the airport with all her belongings and two shopping bags is standing here in front of you tonight. I have a beautiful little house bought and paid for by me. I am self-supporting through my own contributions. Always have been, always will be. I have a little car out there that's paid for. I have the design of clothes I want, and I have a very, very sweet life. But more important than any of those things, I have peace in my mind. I have a peaceful heart. I have a loving soul, a peaceful mind, and a quiet mind. You know, and also a little money in the bank. That doesn't help. You know, that helps a little bit, you know. And I think about the woman who arrived in Honolulu not knowing where she'd lay her head, not knowing, long distance hanging up, nobody wanting anything to do with me, no one. And I stand here before you tonight, and I'm so full of hope, and that's the most important thing, so full of joy, so full of love, so full of wonderful people in my life, all over this United States, wherever we go, we are there. My best friend Bessie, when she was about, she just celebrated 16 years, so it was 16 years ago, we reconnected when I came back, and she lived up in San Francisco, and I lived down in Orange, and we would meet, and she was driving me crazy, absolutely driving me crazy. Everything was money, 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 money. See, I'd been out doing what I did, but she was out working and bought all this property. Should I buy this? Should I sell this? What should I do? And it's money, 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 and I could barely pay the rent. I'm slamming the phone down on her, and we're just completely, just drive me crazy. And I slammed the phone down one day, and I said, I'm done. I'm just done. I can't do this anymore. But now I'm surrounded by sober women. And my friend Sharon said to me, you can't treat her like that. If you want to part ways, do it, but not that way. You owe her an amends. And as soon as she said that, it's like I was struck by lightning. There had been whispers about her drinking, and I hadn't paid attention to them because I hadn't been around. And it dawned on me, she has the same disease I do. So I called her the next day, and I said, Bessie, just hear my heart. Just hear it. I think you have the same disease that I have, and there's nothing, nothing I can do about it. But there's a woman up in San Francisco. Her name is Jenny Peacock. Here's her number. If you want to find a different way of living, call her. And I hung up the phone, and I stood back, not knowing what would happen, not knowing what would happen. And the phone would start to ring, and she'd be mad, and she'd be crazy, and then I heard this little voice that say, yes, I'm going to give it a try. And Bessie just celebrated 16 years of sobriety. And what I learned from that is, as crazy and as angry as she was, is I got to open my eyes for the first time with this wonderful gift we have been given. You know, we come in here and we rug and we kiss up against each other, tell each other how wonderful and how gorgeous we are. We forget that we have a disease that kills. That right now, around the corner, people are dying of this disease. They don't know where to go or what to do. But it's Saturday night. It's 7 o'clock here, and where am I? Santa Maria. The lights are on. I don't care if it's Santa Maria, Boston, New York, Chicago, Honolulu. It's meeting time. The chairs are out. The lights are on. The coffee's made. Leaders lead. Readers read. Speakers speak. And no matter where in the world, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is there for all loved ones and for us every single day of our life. This is the organization we belong to. This is the most beautiful, incredible way of life I have ever imagined. People ask me about my life. How did you ever get where you were? There's no way I could have imagined this kind of life that I have today. And it's all the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you. If I could have all the newcomers stand, which we didn't have. Anybody re-recognize themselves? Okay. Let's give them all, let's give the speaker another round of big applause. And if you have a moment after the meeting, we would like to, thank her too, please. All right. The next meeting here is the second Saturday of December, which is December 12th. Our speaker will be Tim W. from Santa Barbara. Have I forgotten anything? No? Okay. Okay. All right. So we're getting ready to close the meeting here. As an early AA history, we will close this meeting by simply standing in place, praying Our Father, followed by a simple amen. No slogans, no sayings or crosstalk, just an amen, followed by a moment of silence. So if I could all have you stand, please, and I'll lead us out.